Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Podcast Tuesday, clones. What's going on? Welcome to the Daily Jungle. Hope you had a tremendous day. At least a better one than Adrian Peterson had last night. AP rolled into Minnesota and watched Dalvin Cook knock him out of the record books as the Vikings smashed up the Saints. And the Chargers nearly ran down the Broncos last night until they got stopped by Vance Joseph's whistle. Icing the kicker actually worked. Plus, Baker Mayfield apologized for planting the flag at Ohio State. Bake, I appreciate it, but apology not accepted. Not when you have nothing to apologize for. Also, three really good guests. We had PGA Tour pro Charlie Hoffman. We had Oklahoma head football coach Lincoln Riley and MLB Network and SI's Tom Verducci to break down baseball like an absolute boss. Alvy, roll it. Let me start with the big storyline last night. The big storyline going into the Saints-Vikings game was the return of a Minnesota legend. A legend of the purple and gold. What would it be like to see that legend in different gear? Has enough time passed to heal the old wounds? How would the fans respond? Of course, I'm referring to Randy Moss coming back to the Twin Cities and being inducted into the Ring of Honor last night. And it was awesome. Straight cash, homie.
Straight cash, homie.
Straight cash, homie.
Straight cash, homie.
Meanwhile, Adrian Peterson coming back to Minnesota as a Saint, not nearly as awesome. Straight trash, homie.
Straight cash, homie.
The dude who used to cancel Christmas looked about as fresh as a Christmas tree that's still up in May. And of course, in the build-up to the game, you had all the cliches. Revenge game, circling the date on the calendar. How weird would it be to see him in a gold helmet? Would the Vikings defense be able to stop him? Or would he be so fired up and motivated to prove that team wrong that he would just run all over them? Yeah, well, nothing ever lives up to the hype. And most of all, that. That certainly didn't. Didn't even come close. 9 plays, 6 carries, 18 yards. That's it. A career low in carries and the 3rd worst rushing numbers of his entire career. Yeah, I'm not sure that that's what he had in mind for Viking fans when he came back. In fact, I know it wasn't. When the schedule was released, I doubt that he circled week 1 and said, I'm going to go back there and be the 3rd most productive Saints running back that night behind Mark Ingram and Alvin Kamara. I'll show them. I mean, to use that tired, overplayed metaphor of somebody showing up at a party, wanting to show their ex what they're missing, Adrian rolled in late, without a shower, spilled food all over himself, fell asleep on the couch, and then somebody had to call him an Uber. He was not the life of the party. He was a complete non-factor. It wouldn't have been better if he had fumbled 3 times or done something, or it would have been. I mean, give me 3 fumbles. Give me something, anything, because the worst thing that you could be is boring. That was like the Hollywood reboot that nobody wanted and nobody saw. You know, what happened to the Adrian specials, the special plays that Peterson was asked about during the week? Because there was absolutely nothing special about that performance last night. Now, I'm not going to damn a guy after only 1 game, especially one where his team fell into a hole. But Adrian Peterson looked like a 32-year-old running back last night, which is exactly what he is. And you want to talk about a letdown? That wasn't even interesting. The only interesting thing about it was when Peterson appeared to unload on Sean Payton on the sideline. TV cameras caught Peterson appearing to yell at Payton late in the first half and then stare him down. Payton turned and appeared to respond, but afterwards both men said that it was not an issue. Peterson especially.
Just communicating with him. One thing I said to him was, hey, you know, gotta just run this inside zone. And we came out and we ran it.
Oh, okay, sure. You were just yelling, let's run the inside zone, and then staring him down. Happens all the time. You were just kind of emphatic about that. Yeah, I'll buy that. And if you don't, Adrian's got a little more for you.
It's not my first time being in a situation where the media or, you know, not everyone here, but people jump to conclusions and make their own assumptions when they didn't have no idea what was going on or what was said. You know, I could have said, I love you. And it was super aggressive, you know? But yeah, it's no issue. We have bigger fish to fry.
Good one, AP. Yeah, first off, I don't know how many running backs who are getting limited action are going to shout, I love you, at their coach while trying to shoot lasers out of their eyes. And by the way, what would he be getting bent at Sean Payton for anyway? Payton was not the problem. Peterson was. Again, it's only one game and not a particularly good one for any of the Saints. So I'm not going to sit here and declare that Adrian Peterson, New Orleans Saint, is like Jerry Rice, Seattle Seahawk, or Joe Namath, Los Angeles Ram. But we're on that highway now, and we're picking up speed. He couldn't make it out of the first half of the first game of the season without getting pissed about his workload. If he couldn't do that, that's not good. That's not good at all. If that really is the case, then it's going to be a very long season in New Orleans for Adrian Peterson, or a very short one. That could not have gone any worse. 1-800-636-8686. Your thoughts on that? This guy's got one via email. Hey, Rome, when you see Adrian Peterson's head start bucking, you can cancel flag day.
He's a man child now. That Peterson, I tell you, when he hits that daylight and you see that head start bucking, I mean, you can cancel Christmas.
Lo Neal obviously did not say that after last night's game. Charlie Hoffman is my guest. Charlie, it's great to have you back in the jungle. How are you?
Good, Romy. It's been too long.
It has been way too long. And as I mentioned, Charlie, you are having a monster season. You're a member of that President's Cup team. You've got the BMW Championship this week. Dial me in. How is life for you right now?
Life's changed a little bit. Having two kids, two girls, going to school. It's been a great change the last few years. And the golf game's been unbelievable. It's been a lot of fun this summer playing good golf and just having a great time out there and enjoying life.
You're playing great golf. Now, what about the girls? How old are the girls, and what's it like being a father?
It's awesome. They're 6 and 4 this Saturday, running around San Diego County, going to soccer games, being a dad. I mean, it's just fun. It's fun being a father and enjoying their new adventures in life, and it's fun to be around when I can.
Yeah, you know it. Charlie Hoffman joining us. Now, there was a moment last month at the WGC Bridgestone Invitational when you were 3 back with 3 to play, and you and your caddy were discussing your options for a shot, and you said, quote, I'm trying to win a golf tournament. I'm tired of finishing second, end quote. Then you go out and you crush one that clears the water from 282 yards out. The moment went viral. What do you remember about that and your approach to that shot?
Well, the backstory is that it's known that you never go for that green in 2 unless
sure.
you have an iron into
right.
it. So it's one of those. I knew I was 3 back. Hideki was playing amazing golf, and I felt the only way I could win that golf tournament was to make an eagle or birdie there, because 18 is really not a birdie hole. So it was one of those that I was just in the moment. Finished lost in a playoff a few weeks earlier, I didn't want to finish second again. I wanted to win the event.
Charlie Hoffman joining us. All right, so go back. You missed out on qualifying for the President's Cup team on points by a fraction of a point. So what kind of thoughts were you having before the captain's picks were announced? I mean, did you feel like you were a lock, or did you not allow yourself to think that until it was announced?
You know what? That week was tough. Yeah, I can sort of control my own destiny if I play halfway decent at the Dell Championship in Boston. I'm on the team, but just fell a little bit short. I think someone told me less than a quarter of a point. But I was in contact with Stricker. I confirmed as much as you can confirm that I was going to be a pick. And when the picks came out on Wednesday, but you know, it was a few sleepless nights, and obviously would like to get it done on my own. But you know, Kevin Chappell is going to be a great teammate also, and we were battling to get on that team for our first time, and we can't wait to represent our country and play the President's Cup.
Right now, on that point, you and I spoke years ago about how special it would be for you to represent the U.S. in a Ryder Cup or a President's Cup. Now that's official, now that you're on that team, how does that feel, and then what does it mean to represent the U.S.?
Yeah, I'm a 40-year-old virgin. I mean, I'm the first time on a team event is going to be the President's Cup at 40 years old. Obviously, would like to come a little bit earlier, and And you know what? It's going to, I mean, I've never represented my country in anything, really. My father was in the Army, so he did his deeds on that side and went to Vietnam. And it's nice to, not on any of that level, but be able to represent my country doing something and playing the game of golf that I love. And it's going to be a blast. We've got a great team, a great camaraderie, and I can't wait to be a part of it.
I think you said it best. You're a 40-year-old virgin. You've been saving yourself, Charlie. How do you think it's going to feel?
Hopefully it feels really, really good. I can't wait. I mean, it's one of those dreams come true. I think I'm gonna look back and kind of wish I was on a few more of those teams through the years, but I'm glad I'm going to be able to experience it.
Charlie Hoffman joining us. Now, there's this piece right now on golfdigest.com that has some amazing stories about you from back in the day. So incredible that I want to check with you to make sure that some of these are actually real. As an example.
I haven't seen it.
Okay, I'll give you an example. When you were at UNLV, is it true that you guys were coming home from a match in Texas and you saw some mule deer on the side of the road and tried to see if you could outrun them?
Fact. That is a fact. The coach was driving the van one of those big vans back in the day, and he's driving, and I slide that door open and hit the ground running as the car's going. So I had a little head start. I thought I could do it. Didn't happen, though.
Yeah, I was going to say, how'd that go for you?
fell a little bit short on that one. And I'm to be quite honest, the best question was, the coach goes, well, if you did catch that deer, what were you going to do with it?
Right.
Which was
right.
A very valid question that never crossed my mind, obviously.
Yeah, and your answer was what?
Probably get kicked in the face by its legs. I mean, who knows?
Dude, you're fast, but not that fast. All right, something else that keeps coming up from the guys you play with, whether it's in college or on tour, is that you've got the perfect personality for a team event like this. So how do you explain your approach to the team atmosphere when you play an individual sport, obviously?
You know what, I think I get along well with all these guys. You know what, I like to keep it loose. I don't like to take it too seriously, and I think this team actually has a lot of guys like that on it. And hopefully I can add a little bit of something behind the scenes, and just, you know, obviously the most important thing is to go out and play good golf. But I'm pretty lighthearted, like to have a good time, pull a few pranks here and there, and I think that'll be good for everybody.
Yeah, but at the same time, don't get that twisted. That does not mean that you're not competitive. As an example, Jeremy Anderson, who was a teammate of yours at UNLV, said that the two of you would compete all the time, and he always liked his chances, but whenever there was something on the line, you would turn into, quote, a world beater. I got smart. I told him, I'm done, man, unless you and I want to be partners, end quote. So how much does your game and your approach change when the pressure is at its very highest, and can you dial it up in those matters?
Yeah, you know what, it's something that I've always done. It seems like it doesn't matter if we're pitching quarters or playing ping pong or comes to the golf course. When it comes down to it, I get this like intense focus and that I love to feed off of. And it's something that obviously you don't always get when you're playing the sports, but when it comes on and you're in contention, it's a great feeling, and I will definitely love to feed off of it.
Charlie, are you a Charger fan? And if so, where do you come out about what happened last night? The team moved. Ooh. They lost another heartbreaker. What's your sense?
I am still a fan. I stayed up as late as I could to handle it here in Chicago. We're watching with a few other San Diego guys. You know what? I left in the middle of the third quarter because I didn't think they could come back. And then I wake up this morning and get on ESPN and check it out, and I lose by three, and I'm like, oh, that's not bad. They actually came back, and then I push play on one of the highlights and see what actually happened, and I'm like, how is this even possible? I mean, they go to L.A., and they still doing their old tricks again, though.
Charlie Hoffman, my guest. Now, last time you and I spoke, we discussed your legendary haircut, the skullet. My man, I can't help but notice you're no longer rocking that look. What happened?
The skullet no longer lives, but the thinning up top does. But, you know, it's one of those, back to the family, kids and all that stuff, and a little bit of responsibility, and thought it was sort of time to let it go. The long story short, my daughter hadn't had a haircut for a couple years, and when she was younger, and I needed a haircut, obviously, and we sort of went into that barbershop together and both got our haircut, and it was just a pretty cool experience.
Then you've got Oklahoma quarterback Baker Mayfield. He did apologize yesterday for planting that flag in the block O after Oklahoma's impressive 31-16 beatdown of Ohio State, and after ripping up the Buckeyes secondary and throwing four second half TDs, Mayfield wants you to know that he's extremely sorry if he disrespected anybody at all.
I told you guys that last week that it was, I knew that it was going to have a lot of implications on the playoffs, and so that's the way we were prepared, and so it was an emotional game, and so after the game, it did not mean for it to be disrespectful towards any Ohio State people at all, especially not the team or the players, because they're a great team and a great program. So I didn't mean it to be disrespectful at all. I mean, we do the flag thing at OU Texas, and so that's just something that I got caught up in, an emotional win. And, you know, yeah, it should have been something I did in the locker room, so I apologize for doing it in the middle of the field.
And that's pretty sincere, pretty heartfelt, pretty genuine. Got away from it and said, you know what, I'd like to have that one back. You know what, Baker? From me to you, I do not accept your apology. That is not an apology that I'm going to accept. The only apology I accept is the one that you make to the Ohio State secondary for setting their bodies on fire in the second half, or to the state of Ohio for your complete ownership of the horseshoe, or for being sorry that you're not sorry. Or you could have just gone Conor McGregor with it, assembled the entire media, made sure the mic was on, and then dropped this.
I'd like to take this chance to apologize to absolutely nobody. The double champ does what the f*** he wants.
Such an amazing moment. I don't care what happened against Mayweather. I don't care what happened against Nate Diaz. I don't care what happens going forward. That literally was one of the funniest things I've ever seen in my life. Conor McGregor getting up there and setting it up like he was going to apologize. You know, I want to say that Conor McGregor will never apologize to anybody for anything, but then you saw that video where he apologized to Dana White. And Dana said, you got nothing to apologize for. You did great. But Conor getting up in front of the media and the world and saying, I'd like to apologize for absolutely nothing.
I'd like to take this chance to apologize to absolutely nobody. The double champ does what the f*** he wants.
I'd like to take this chance to apologize to absolutely nobody. The double champ does what the bleep he wants. And you're going to tell me you have a problem with this guy?
I'd like to take this chance to apologize to absolutely nobody. The double champ does what the f*** he wants.
On second thought, maybe it's Ohio State who should be apologizing to you, Bake, for having field turf that could not be punctured by a flag stick, for making it impossible to finish off that perfect moon landing, for laying down in the second half after you got that offense rolling. We wanted to see a shootout, not a beatdown. But that flag plant was epic. Your performance was legendary, and you and Lincoln Riley just put the college football world on notice once again that this Oklahoma team is not like some of the others. So I'm sorry, Baker. Apology not accepted. Not when you have nothing to apologize for. Apologize for what? Being awesome? Playing lights out? Going onto the road in an extremely hostile environment and dominating? You're sorry for that? Why? Sooners head coach Lincoln Riley is my guest. Lincoln, it's so good to have you back. How are you?
I'm good, Jim. How you doing?
Lincoln, I'm great. Great to visit with you once again. Thanks so much. You're on the road. You're going up against the second-ranked team in the country in front of more than 109,000 fans. Yet you went in there, Lincoln, expecting to win that game. So what did you see from your team in camp that made you feel like you were going to win that game?
The team just had a great mentality all the way through. We really took it as a challenge to try to play well early in the season. We didn't feel like in the previous couple of seasons that we had put our best foot forward early, and that was just the team's just been on a mission, and they had again great spring practice, great camp. Really, I think we've got a lot of strong leadership, and they're really, really motivated to play well early, and I think that preparation, was a big part of us getting the win in Columbus.
Yes, it seems to me that that's key. You want to get out quickly, you want to get off to a good start, but when you talk about a mission, it looked like a team on a mission. It looked like a team that was running on some premium fuel. Is it only about getting off to a good start, or if there is that kind of fuel, what's it coming from?
Well, I just think this team has a strong desire to win, a strong desire to play well. It's a very competitive, very close-knit group, and And then, of course, you know, the chance to go play, you know, in a game like that with two really good football teams, you know, in an atmosphere like that where everybody in the country and a lot of people around the world are watching. I mean, that's just, you know, something that, you know, here at Oklahoma, that's just something that we love. We love those games. We love to play on the road. We were really, really motivated going into that game.
Oklahoma head football coach Lincoln Riley joining us. You know, outside the program, you're going to hear the phrase statement win. It was a statement win thrown around quite a bit. Does it feel to you like that was a statement win, or does that feel like a win and that there's no statement that needs to be made at this point?
I realize it was a big game, and I'm not gonna deny that. It was an important game. Again, when you get a chance to play a team that quality, you know, an out-of-conference game that doesn't happen every year, you know, and, you know, I think our athletic director, Joe Castiglione, has been really smart and calculated about how he scheduled those, and I love the fact that we, you know, continue to challenge ourselves in the non-conference games. And it was a big game, but it's only big if we continue to improve and continue to win games as a team, and that's been our message to our guys is, it was a big one, but it was only one. And we got a lot of ball left, and we got to keep improving as a team.
Yeah, I get that. And I understand what you're talking about when you say, hey, listen, if that's the highlight of our year, I'm going to be disappointed. So how'd you approach it? I mean, is there a 24-hour rule? Did you celebrate it for 24 hours? Did you as the head coach celebrate that for 1 hour? Did you allow yourself to enjoy it? And if so, for how long?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, we enjoyed it, you know, after the game. You know, the post-game locker room celebration was a great time, and then, you know, the plane ride home was fun, you know, just, you know, enjoying the guys, getting to spend some time with them. But we didn't touch down here until about 3 o'clock in the morning, and by the time we all got a little bit of rest, it was we got up here Sunday, and it was on to land and the rest of the season.
Baker Mayfield had a huge game, of course, 386 yards passing, 3 touchdowns. What did you make of the way he showed up on Saturday night?
Yeah, it's his kind of environment, you know. He's always, you know, enjoyed those, always embraced, you know, those tough road games. He played very well, trusted his teammates, you know, made big plays when we needed him, you know, was very smart with the football. He played like a really, really good player, a veteran quarterback that's been there before, and certainly led our team.
Yeah, I mean, see, that's the thing. Beyond the physical and the stats that show up in a box score, there's the fact that he's 10-0 in true road games. What's it say about him as a leader and the impact that he has beyond his stats?
Yeah, you know, he doesn't look at those games like challenges. He looks at them like, you know, he enjoys them, and he enjoys the atmosphere. He enjoys, you know, 99% of the people in that stadium being against you, and he just always embraced that. So he's been a really good road player all of his career, and I think that's a big reason why we've been such a good road team here the last few years. And so he just got a great mentality towards it, you know, where a lot of people are just hoping to survive it.
And Lincoln, you're looking for guys like that. If there were a lot of guys like that, that'd be a great thing, but there aren't. That's what makes him so special. And I've asked the question before, but to me it's just so unique. When you've got a guy like that that does not see it as a challenge but sees it as an opportunity, loves the fact that 99% of them are against him, what is that and where does that come from? Are they wired like that? Can you teach that? What is it exactly?
Oh, I think for the most part you're either wired like that or you aren't. And, you know, everybody will say that, but most people don't really feel that. You know, most people would rather be at the comforting, you know, spot at home where everybody's cheering for you and this and that. And now, a lot of people don't have that. They don't like the pressure of it, or don't like, you know, kind of being out there by yourself. But he does, and he always has. But I do think it's been something, again, that's carried over to our team, and I think there's just a general feeling of that around our whole team. You know, that they enjoy being on the road. They enjoy the challenges that you face when you do that.
Yeah, and to be fair, he's not the only one that stepped up. He stepped up in a huge way, but you got a true freshman like running back Trey Sermon, safety Robert Barnes. I mean, these guys did. As head coach, I know that you got to be happy to see them step up and that you've got a team of guys who did it. One more thought about Mayfield. He apologized for planting the flag at the center of Ohio State's field. I think as apologies go, Lincoln, it's as good as it gets. In your opinion, did he have anything to apologize for, and would you rather he had not done that, or was it okay?
I was fine with it because I think that's how he really felt. You know, again, he was emotional about it. I mean, how could you not be? And you know, he's a fiery guy to begin with. So, you know, he did it, and he owned up to, hey, you know what? I wish I maybe would have done it in another way. But you know, that's I don't think it's I think a lot's been made out of it, which that's just kind of the world we live in, but it shouldn't take away from the quality of game that was. There was two really good football teams on the field, and to me, that needs to be the focus.
So glad you said that. I don't think the guy's got anything to apologize for whatsoever. I mean, we want these guys to show some emotion. I don't think he disrespected anybody. That was a huge moment, a huge win. The guy was feeling it. You want to see that. I don't think he has anything to apologize for. Before I let you go, you made the point that everybody's going to want to anoint us now. We've got a long ways to go. I get it. They're going to want to anoint you guys, but of course they're going to want to anoint you as well. And I know you'll deflect that, but is there any feeling of validation, any feeling of, you know what, how do you like me now? Maybe you shouldn't have disrespected or sold us short. Personally, how do you feel after a win like that?
No, not really. I mean, maybe you have some of that if you were coaching at a different program. But, you know, this program's, you know, a little bit different, you know, as far as all the history here. You know, that's what's expected here. You know, that's what our job is here. That's what a lot of people have done very well before us, and we're trying to do our part to continue that and hopefully find a few ways to make it even a little bit better.
Lastly, it's on to Tulane. What's your biggest concern heading into Saturday's game against Tulane?
We've got to make sure we keep improving. You know, we can't listen to all the noise on the outside. Sometimes it's harder to not listen when it is positive, and so we've got to be a mentally tough team. And, you know, we covered up a lot of mistakes the other night by our mentality and how hard we played. So we've got to keep the mentality and the effort at a high level like it was, but we've got to continue to improve and clean up a lot. So that'll certainly be our challenge this week.
If you're a San Diego Charger fan, what do you make of what you saw last night? Let me give you my thoughts on that game, and then I'm going to go to the phones and get your thoughts. Look, Charger fans have found a variety of ways to have their hearts ripped out over the past few years, including the team's departure from San Diego. But they found a new way last night. In fact, last night was kind of a greatest hits of brutal moments. For starters, now that the regular season has started, you are in fact confronted with the reality that they are the Los Angeles Chargers. Reality. Fact. After decades in San Diego, I know that that's a very bitter pill for many Charger fans to have to swallow. So it was bad enough that they were introduced as the Los Angeles Chargers, and then even worse when the referee made this call.
Charge timeout, San Diego. Fire the clock expiring.
That's got to hurt. That's got to sting. And no, that's not some replacement ref going with Orlando 93 red. No, that's a regular ref who just said San Diego out of habit. It happens. It happens to us all. And every time it does, San Diego Charger fan dies just a little bit more. But I am not here to make that worse. I am not going to remind you of the 17-point fourth quarter lead that the team blew in the season opener against Kansas City, or the bomb to T.Y. Hilton in week 3 last year with less than 90 seconds left that led to that loss against the Colts, or Drew Brees throwing 2 TDs in the final 5 minutes to come from behind in week 4, or the fumbled snap on a potential game-tying field goal in week 5. You know all that. I'm not going to do any of that. It serves no purpose here. Because this isn't about last year, it's about last night. And last night, the Chargers came out and they got steamrolled early on. They went into that madhouse in Mile High and they struggled to get anything going offensively. While Trevor Siemian went to work on them defensively. It did not look like it was their night. They were down 24-7 heading into the fourth. And you may think you know all the numbers about the Chargers in the fourth. How about this one? They were 1-155 in their history. 1-155 when trailing by 17 or more in the fourth quarter. Game over, right? Let's not get into that. I mean, wrong.
Let's not get into that.
The defense picks off Siemian with under 11 minutes to go. The offense converts that into a touchdown, 24-14. L.A. kicks off, and then Denver gives the ball right back to them on a Jamal Charles fumble. One play later, this happens.
Shotgun snap. Rivers sets. Cocks his arm. Goes long. Arching spiral. He's got Benjamin in the end zone. Over the shoulder catch. Touchdown in the corner. What a throw by Phillip Rivers. 38-yard touchdown strike. And the Chargers are back in business.
Thanks to Westwood One for that. I mean, what a pretty pass that was. What a pretty pass that was. And suddenly that game wasn't so ugly anymore. Hey, look, I don't root. I don't ever root. You know that. I don't root for anything other than team content. That's my favorite team. Not the Chargers, not the Rams, not the Steelers, not the Bengals, not the Pats. I don't have a favorite team. Team content is my favorite team. But I got to tell you something. Phillip Rivers, to me, is a stud. This guy's such a great leader. Great leader and a great player. And I think at this point in time, if you've got a problem with him, you got a problem with you. I mean, even if you're a rival, how do you not respect what that guy's about? So Denver gets the ball back. They miss a field goal. And then the implosion is on. Except the Chargers could not cash in on that blunder. But the defense did come up with another big stop. The Chargers move into field goal range to set up this 44-yarder to tie it.
To tie it. Ball put down. Right-footed kick is up. Arching up and to our right. And it is. They called a timeout.
Oh, man. Great kick. Great kick.
Part of the snap. Second charge timeout.
So the kick is up and the kick is good. And I'm thinking, man, this is going to be an unbelievable win for San Diego. L.A. If they can pull this off. But Denver coach Vance Joseph gets the timeout in before the kick. So, of course, they had to run it back. And then this.
No wind to our right. The snap is down. Oh, the kick may have been blocked. And it was. The right-footed kick was blocked. It was blocked. Crew got the trajectory low. Denver has blocked the game-tying field goal. It lands short. Line drives left. 1 second left.
So brutal. Blocked ball game. Icing the kicker never, ever works. Ever. Until it does. And in this case, they didn't ice the kicker. They iced the offensive line. Because that's not on the kicker. That was entirely on the O-line. No way you're kicking over Shelby Harris when he gets through the line the way he did. And the moment he got his meat hook on that kick, Charger fan had to be like, here we go again. Here we go again. Nothing's changed. I get that. I understand that. And maybe I'm in the minority, but I reject that. I reject that because here you don't go again. And yes, I said it. There is no such thing as a good loss. But there is a ton of talent on this team. And the way they battled back on the road against a very good Broncos defense, an elite Broncos defense, I thought was pretty macho. Phillip Rivers isn't here for your toughness. The guy wants to win. And he'll get the wins. Because to me, this does feel like a different team. And I'm not saying it because they're in a different city with a different head coach. They have the look and feel to me of a different team. And yeah, I said that too. Brutal loss. But it says right here, this is not the same old Chargers. The same old Chargers would have it happen over and over again. This crew won't. They just won't. And I'm going on record right now and saying it. Brutal loss. Brutal loss, and it took them too long to get going. But this group's going to be different. Tom Verducci is my guest. Tom, it is so good to have you back. How are you?
I am great. How are you doing, Jim?
Tom, I'm great. Great to visit with you. I always appreciate the time. Let's go back a few weeks, Tom, to August 25th. The Dodgers were 91-36, absolutely killing it. At that time, what were you thinking about that Dodger team?
I'm wondering how high they can go with the win total, right? See if they get to the 116 territory of the Mariners about 15 years ago. You know, people were, and rightfully so, framing them among the greatest teams like the win total was going.
Last night, Tom, which is the longest streak they've had since they moved to L.A., and as you point out, they're a 1-0 win over a Padres team away from a 17-game losing streak. What has happened to these guys?
Yeah, listen, I think they're a little bit of a victim of the fact that they had such a big lead. To me, this season has all been about making sure that Kershaw, Hill, and now Darvish, who essentially replaces Julio Urias, the kid who broke down, making sure those guys are on point when October begins, when the playoffs begin. So they have not pushed their starters much. They have a ton of depth. They're running guys in and out of the lineup. Adrian Gonzalez came back, and they want to get him some at-bats. Curtis Granderson comes over. They want to get him in the lineup. Well, Gonzalez hasn't hit. Granderson hasn't hit. Enrique Hernandez hasn't hit. Jock Peterson hasn't hit. Guys are in and out of the lineup. Starting pitchers have too much rest, in my book, to stay sharp. because they know they've had such a big lead that they can play basically glorified spring training. So it wouldn't shock me if I see this team once October begins starting pitchers. No, but I have to do this. I'll go back to 2005. The White Sox won the World Series. I'll never forget Paul Konerko in the clubhouse after they won saying, best thing that happened to us is we almost lost a 15-game lead. They were down, all the way down at a game and a half with 2 weeks left in the season, and they kicked it in. They played well. They won 8 of their last 10, and they almost ran the table. They only lost once in the postseason. He said playing with that urgency late really got them dialed in. I think that the Dodgers have to do here before they get to October, but I'm not too worried about them. I don't think this is something that we're going to see carry into the playoffs.
Tom Verducci joining us. That's really interesting insight that Paul Konerko said, look, that was a good thing for us, and then we had our sense of urgency. I mean, was it as simple as that? Can the Dodgers just throw the switch? Can they just say, hey, look, none of this matters. We've set this thing up the right way. We know who we are. We just need to go right now. Can they do that?
Yeah, they can. This reminds me a little bit of, say, late in the NBA season where guys are resting their veteran starters, right? And then you get to postseason play in the NBA. What happens? The rotations get a lot tighter, right? Guys you're losing games with now are not starting games. Kenta Maeda is not going to see the mound in a playoff game. Ryu is not going to see the mound in a playoff game. You know, some of these guys who are getting playing time, and don't forget Corey Seager was out for a while, which threw their lineup for a loop. You'll see a different team. The rotation gets shorter when you get into the postseason. Now, again, I think it's important for the Dodgers to get a good feeling going between now and game one of the playoffs. And that could happen in the last week of the season, but most important, they need – it also, to me, it comes down to Kershaw, Hill, and Darvish. Those three will really – as they go, that's the way the Dodgers will go.
Okay, now one more thing. Tom Verducci joining us. We haven't talked about this, and you wrote for SI.com this morning, and you made this point. Dodger hitters love to hit the ball in the air, so what are pitching staffs doing to adjust to that, and how is it working?
No question. I mean, we've seen this here during the losing streak. You know, the Dodgers see – more four-seam fastballs than any team in baseball. That's because they have a lot of guys, starting with Justin Turner, who love to hit the ball in the air. That's their whole MO, right? They want to hit the ball in the air. That's where the damage is, avoid ground balls. Well, that makes you vulnerable to fastballs up in the zone. And Granderson, Gonzalez, Hernandez, Grandal, Peterson, Puig, all those guys are very weak on high fastballs. And that's how they're getting beat during this stretch here. And when I look ahead to postseason matchups, I see that the Rockies and the Nationals rank 1-2 at throwing high fastballs. And the way Steven Strasburg is throwing right now, oh my goodness, they're a scary matchup for the Dodgers if it comes to that.
I'm trying to get to the Indians, and I will in 1 second, but can the Dodgers make any kind of adjustment before the postseason, or is that pretty much who they are?
Jim, I think this is who they are. I think this can flip in a hurry. I mean, you know, they got off to that great record over 4.5 months. That's more of who they are than these last 3 weeks. They know that. This thing can turn in a hurry. I know it looks bad. It's historically bad at this point in terms of a losing streak. But I still think the same talent that got them there is there. And listen, there's nothing better than when your ace goes out there and settles the world, right? That's chicken soup for a baseball team. That makes you feel good all over when your ace goes out there and just owns a game. And that's what Kershaw is going to have to do.
That is chicken soup for a baseball team. Tom Verducci joining us. All right, on the flip side of that, you've got something that's historically good. MLB Network has Detroit at Cleveland tonight. Cleveland's going for their 20th straight win. How good are these guys, and how do you compare this year's squad to last year's squad, Tom?
Well, Jim, I know last year's squad won 14 in a row, but that was an exciting bunch who was pulling out these comeback wins, relying on their great bullpen. This team is just blowing people out. I mean, we literally have never seen in our lifetimes, maybe even before us, a team that has blown people out for this long the way they have. I mean, they've outscored their opponents during this streak by 100 runs. I mean, there's very few saves even during this streak because they just jump on people early and they don't let people back into games. So they're just completely dominating people. Again, I'll go back to what I said about the Dodgers. They're big three. It comes down to the pitchers, starting pitchers in the postseason. As much as we love to talk about bullpens, it's certainly a big part of the Indians' part. You run Kluber out there, Carrasco. Trevor Bauer is way improved from last year, and that's how they're beating people during the streak. I mean, they're not letting teams up for air. They get a lead early, and the game's over. So it's a better team than last year because they're just dominating.
All right, so is there any concern that you might have about Cleveland as they get ready for the postseason?
No, and the funny part is they could actually be better because, you know, Kipnis is coming back soon. He may wind up in center field now that Bradley Zimmer is hurt. You're still waiting on Andrew Miller. He's been throwing off a mound, so he should be back soon. Michael Brantley may or may not come back. You know, this is a team that hasn't been at full strength during the streak. So I think in a postseason environment, and they've got one of the best, I believe, postseason managers of all time. Terry Francona is just unbelievable the way he has his team ready to play and the way he runs a postseason game, because they are different than regular season games. He knows it. So I think in terms of talent, this team will have more talent in the postseason. Not to say they're going to be better, but on paper, they're going to have more talent available.
And I agree, especially about Tito. He is something else when it turns to the postseason. Tom, before you go, I thought you had a really interesting note the other day when you compared the numbers of Mark McGwire and Gary Sanchez through the first 150 games, and the stats are nearly identical. What's your reaction and takeaway when you see that?
Well, I never saw anybody with more raw power than Mark McGwire. You know, I'll never forget during that streak in 98, and I was at so many of those games the second half of the season with Mark. One day he showed me his bat, and I was amazed at it because the wood of the bat was completely dented with the seams of the baseballs. In other words, he was hitting the ball so hard, it was literally leaving indentations on the wood. And you know how hard the wood is on a baseball bat.
Sure.
So, you know, he stood out for me for tremendous raw power. We know the chemical enhancement as well had a part of that. I'm not avoiding that. But Sanchez, to me, has that kind of raw power. I mean, he's got a tremendous swing. You know, he's a little vulnerable to breaking balls, but just in terms of raw power, this kid is the real deal. He's got a long way to go in terms of improving as a backstop, receiving the ball, framing the ball, especially blocking the ball. But when you put his power behind the plate, remember, McGwire was a first baseman. You know, there were other first basemen who hit with that kind of power. I don't know any other catcher in the game today who has the kind of raw power that Gary Sanchez has. So this is a generational kind of power hitter.
You know, in addition to everything you've got going, I mentioned you've got a new book out, The Cubs Way, The Zen of Building the Best Team in Baseball and Breaking the Curse. What do you make of how they've handled the season after winning the World Series, and how do they look to you right now?
I don't think they look good. I don't think they've looked good all year. I don't think they've played with any urgency the entire season. They've sort of played down to the National League, especially in their division. The whole league basically is down, but especially their division. It may come back to bite them. You know, they have a series coming up here with St. Louis, then they go to Milwaukee, then they go to St. Louis after that. So the schedule is tough for them. They have nothing guaranteed at this point. You know, it's interesting to me. I was talking to Theo Epstein recently about this, about the human nature of coming back after the World Series and after you've won. No World Series champion has come back and won their division the next year since the 2009 Phillies. That's a long time ago. World Series champions average only 83 wins the next year. Now flip it and look at World Series losers, right? All of them in the last 7-8 years have made the playoffs, and they've averaged 93 wins. And now we see the Indians playing like gangbusters. I think it's human nature. The team that wins just can't get away from reliving a magical season. The team that loses can't wait to put it behind them and write a whole new narrative. And I think that's in play for both the Cubs and the Indians.
Hey, you know, one last thought. Since you wrote that book, I mean, this whole zen of building the best team in baseball, the zen of the Cubs, is the zen of the Cubs and what Theo built there that different than the zen of the Red Sox and what Theo built there?
Yeah, it is. I'll tell you the biggest difference real quickly. In Boston, he was an early adopter to sabermetrics, right? And he thought, I can just build the team based on numbers. Give me guys who get on base, give me pitchers who strike people out, and I'll beat you no matter what their character is. When things broke apart in Boston his last year, 2011, that terrible September, he realized that character did matter. And he made that job one when he got to the Cubs. Yeah, we're going to still apply the same principles of advanced metrics, but now kind of people. And that's what he did. That's why he put a priority on getting people like Rizzo and Schwarber and Bryant. You know, listen, they can play. It starts with talent. But he emphasized character a whole lot more in Chicago than he ever did in Boston.
Email.
This email reads, I'm a Vikings fan, and when I get hyped, I like to take my shirt off.
Guest and speaker tonight is going to be Troy Nicholas. Troy, come on up here. How we feel another day? Let's get hyped!
Let's go!
Hey, I like to get hyped for games! When I get hyped, I take my shirt off! I take it off! I feel off! I can't hear you, know that! I'm not too big on speeches. I really like
Hey, Avi, you can drop Ragnar on that, but that's got nothing to do with the Vikings. Like, you're only helping this guy, Kevin Pagano, who sent that. Hey, Kevin, that's got nothing to do with anything. That's gratuitous. You only wanted to hear Troy Nicholas. He doesn't play for the Vikings. He plays for the Cardinals. What did that have to do with anything at all? I mean, yeah, in a way, I wanted to hear it myself. And even Alvy picking you up with Ragnar. Ragnar's got nothing to do with that. Quote, I'm a Vikings fan, and when I get hyped, I like to take my shirt off. Not only did he not say that in the NFL, he said that at Notre Dame. He's not a Viking. He's an Arizona Cardinal.
Hey, I like to get hyped for games. When I get hyped, I take my shirt off. I take it off. I feel out. I can't hear you, Notre Dame.
Can't say if I put that, I won't do this, but if I put that on a 45-minute loop and called that episode 3 of the podcast, I'd probably be in the top 10. Just run that thing over and over and again. I love that quote. I get hyped before a game, and when I get hyped, I like to take my shirt off.
Hey, I like to get hyped for games. When I get hyped, I take my shirt off. I take it off. I feel out. I can't hear you, Notre Dame.
Let's get loud. I can't hear you, Notre Dame. That's interesting. So we're in the process of looking for colleges for my older son, Jake. And I've mentioned Notre Dame. I've just brought it up. And so far, he's a little bit ambivalent. I'm going to say, hey, son. You know, I'm going to play that for him. Hey, son. Because Jake spends a lot of time in the weight room. Hey, son, listen to this. Yeah, you want to go to NYU. You want to go to Stanford. You want to go to UC Santa Barbara. You want to go, I don't even know where he wants to go. I'll tell you what, when you hear something like this, this is probably where you want to go. Like South Bend. That's in Indiana, right, Dad?
Hey, I like to get hyped for games. When I get hyped, I take my shirt off. I take it off. I feel out.
Meantime, he is a SoCal. Troy Nicholas went to Servite. Hell, I feel like going back to college hearing that. Make it a double podcast day. Go and get episode 3 of the Jim Rome podcast with boxing legend Oscar De La Hoya, Heisman Trophy winner Lamar Jackson. Do what you do. Tell a friend and make sure you're subscribed. Trust both podcasts. I'm out.